Chapter 2. Buddhist Korea, the Shilla and Korya Kingdoms. Unified Shilla, Kings and Councils. When Kim Yushin and Kim Chun-chu unified most of the Korean peninsula, they created one of the longest-lasting states in history. The Korean Kingdom, established in 676, continued in some form until 1910, and is the basis of the two Koreas today. It fell briefly in the 10th century, but was restored in 935 under the new name of Goryeo, and was renamed Joseon in 1392. Despite these name changes, it was basically the same state, governed by many of the same prominent families. There were differences, however. The first two dynasties, Shilla and Goryeo, were profoundly Buddhist. The Joseon was more Confucian. Thus, the unified Korean kingdom spent 7 centuries in a Buddhist temple and 5 centuries before a Confucian shrine. This was not the only significant change. During the first two Buddhist dynasties, Korea evolved from a collection of semi-autonomous regional strongmen into a more centralized administrative state, and the aristocracy shifted from a group of warrior elites to one of scholar bureaucrats. Shilla was as much a coalition of powerful warrior clans as it was a unified state. The Korean kings were not the all-powerful rulers that are associated with Oriental despotism. They claimed great authority, but in reality they had to share power with the great noble families of the true bone aristocratic rank. In fact, politics consisted of the struggle between the aristocratic clans and the monarchs, each trying to concentrate power in their hands. For a while, the kings succeeded in creating a centralized state with themselves at the center, but then real power began to shift back to local nobles. To counter the threat of the aristocratic clans, Shilla kings needed 2 things, a loyal army directly responsible to them and a dependable source of revenue. Before unification, Shilla armies were headed by aristocrats and organized along clan lines. There was no royal army. So in the 7th and 8th centuries, Shilla kings created one with recruits from Goguryeo, Pyeokche, and the Malgal tribes of Manchuria. Though royal military forces enhanced the power and prestige of the monarch, they were expensive, as was the staff of royal officials who were to govern the greatly enlarged state. Kings tried a number of tax systems to obtain revenue and gain control over the countryside, the most radical of which was the able-bodied land system. Derived from Chinese models, this was based on the idea that the state owned all the land. Agricultural holdings were periodically redistributed to individual households based on the number of able-bodied adult males each one had, and the households would pay taxes directly to the royal government. This ensured that rich aristocrats, who would be able to evade taxes, didn't obtain control of the best farmland. Once, historians thought that this was a system that existed only in theory, not practice. It was generally assumed that the state's ability to control society was too limited to make such as this work. How could such a weak state, with so few literate officials, implement such a comprehensive and intrusive system? Yet a strange scrap of paper has challenged what historians previously believed. Most existing information about Shilla dates from histories written 2 or more centuries after its fall, with a few documents remaining from the dynasty itself. In 1933, however, some people were sorting through the Shosoin, a kind of storage house for possessions of the Japanese imperial family located in Kyoto, and they found an old piece of paper wrapped around an item. Upon close inspection, the paper turned out to be, rather bizarrely, a census record from Shilla, dating most likely from 755. On it were accounts of all the property in 4 villages in central Korea. Following the categories of the able-bodied tax system, each household was classified in 1 of 9 grades based on the number of members capable of public labor duty. Everything about the household was listed: the land, the types of fields, rice paddies, dry fields, fields for growing hemp, the number of mulberry, pine nut, and walnut trees, the number of oxen, horses, and even slaves. Historians had simply never thought that such a level of detail about villages far from the capital could have been known or recorded by the state. Perhaps at Schiller's height, the kings were more successful in creating a centralized state than was previously believed. Besides creating a loyal army and squeezing more taxes out of the peasantry, the kings also strengthened their rule by promoting Confucianism, borrowed from China. Confucianism was a line of teaching dating back to the Confucius, whom the Chinese call Gongqi and the Koreans Gongcha, a 5th century BCE thinker who emphasized filial piety, loyalty to the ruler, and respect for authority. Naturally, this system of thought would have been attractive to a king. Royal officials created a Confucian academy with a curriculum based on that used in Tang Dynasty China to train scholars to serve the state. Lower-ranked aristocrats found this an opportunity for advancement to higher office. Many attended the academy, and hundreds went to China for advanced studies. Some of these men, proud of their erudition in classical Chinese and their knowledge of ethics, administration, and law, rose to high administrative office. One of them, Che Chiwan, who served in government in the late 9th century, is still held in high regard for his literary talent. Still, they could never rival the members of the true bone aristocracy, who needed no credentials other than their family background to secure the top posts. Nor did Confucianism supplant Buddhism as the main belief system of the elite. That would come later. Temples, poems, and wine. The Buddhist Aristocratic Society of Schiller. The society the kings reigned over was a strictly hierarchical one, in which one's status was determined by the position of one's parents and grandparents. This was the case in Korea into the 20th century. At the top were the aristocrats, whose status was based on bloodline and wealth, the latter derived from land and slaves. The aristocrats lorded over the great mass of common people, who were mostly farmers. These common people were divided into pyongin, or good people, and a lower stratum of mean or base people. The good people, who made up a majority of the population, were mostly independent farmers or tenant farmers working the land of some noble or perhaps royal family with whom they shared the crops. Some were craftspeople. Commoners, like almost everyone else, inherited their position, and it was extremely difficult to rise above it. Laws ensured that the social ranks were clear. The few commoners who somehow became wealthy were put in their place by legislation that limited the sizes of their houses, required their front gates to be modest, and restricted the size of their carts, which could have no more than 3 horses. They had to wear simple clothing that was clearly distinguished from that of the higher orders. These strictures applied even to their underwear, although it's unclear how this was enforced. Royal decrees prohibited common people from owning luxury goods to avoid confusion of the ranks. For most commoners, that was not a problem, since they were too poor to possess much beyond the basic necessities. They led humble lives, but could console themselves that at least they were not mean people, a miscellaneous category consisting of various hereditary outcasts, such as butchers, tanners, and ferrymen, as well as slaves. We don't know how common slavery was at this time, but the 4-village register found in the Shoso Inn indicates that even some good people owned a few. Like almost all pre-modern societies, Schiller was male-dominated, but compared to later eras, women seem to have had more opportunities, higher status, and fewer restrictions. Unfortunately, we only know about women at the top of society, who sometimes served as family heads. 3 became queens, and appeared to socialize freely with men. For aristocratic men and women, life was filled with festivals, pageantry, and parties. The festival of wine was celebrated at the palace with a winding water channel that held floating drinks. This entertaining feature can still be seen in Gyeongju. Buddhism was the state protective cult. Monks prayed for the kingdom, and rulers lavished money on temples. Initially, Buddhism was the religion of the aristocracy, who favored the flower garland Huaom sect, with its esoteric teachings and elaborate rituals. Aristocrats used Buddhist worship as a means to display their wealth, to make it known that they had the leisure to learn the rituals and demonstrate good taste. With the introduction of the Pure Land sect, which focused on devotion to Amitabha, the Bodhisattva of Mercy, Buddhism took hold among the common people. Followers were promised a reward in the Happy Land, also called the Pure Land, comparable to the Christian idea of heaven. It was an accessible form of Buddhism that appealed to the humble. No costly ceremonies, time-consuming rituals, or mastery of sacred texts were needed to achieve this wonderful afterlife that compensated for all the sufferings of this world. Only prayers and devotion were required. Shilla Koreans were great builders of temples. One of the most important of these, Pulguksa, still stands today. During restoration work carried out on Pulguksa in 1966, printed prayers were found on the stupa that had been placed there at the time of construction in 751. They are the oldest known printed materials in the world. Koreans didn't invent printing. The Chinese did. But they made early use of it to produce multiple copies of Buddhist materials. Temples also required bells, and the Koreans were the greatest bell makers of the pre-modern world, casting the largest ever made up to that time. One, the Punsok Temple Bell, is still the world's second largest. The most famous is the Emile Bell, which can be seen in Gyeongju today. According to legend, the bell maker failed in his first attempts to create it, succeeding only after he cast his daughter into the molten metal. Koreans believe her name can be heard crying out every time the bell is rung. United Shilla and the Wider World. Korea had to deal with the reality of being a small country wedged between China to the west, Japan to the southeast, and Manchuria to the north. An expansionist Yamato, or Nippon as it renamed itself, posed a threat from the sea. A fleet of Japanese ships attacked Shilla in 746. To the north it faced the Manchurian state of Palhae, which was a constant menace during much of the dynasty and had numerous clashes with Shilla. Especially troubling for Korea was that Palhae maintained good relations with Japan. The two allied themselves against Shilla at times. Twice, planned attacks in coordination with Palhae were aborted. After 800, however, Japan ceased to be a threat, and relations with Palhae became more peaceful. In fact, the 9th century was a time of harmony with all its neighbors. With peace, trade flourished, extending to Southeast Asia and even to the Middle East via Arab merchants in China. Shilla exported gold, silver, textiles, and ginseng, the last being one of Korea's most famous exports, prized throughout East Asia. Shilla developed good relations with Tang China. Neither was a threat to the other since Tang was no longer in expansion mode, and Shilla and Tang had a common enemy in Palhae. Regular trade and diplomatic exchanges took place, but in a peculiar manner. Trade was disguised as exchanges of gifts. Koreans sent missions to China in which emissaries bearing gifts for the emperor, so-called tribute, acknowledged him as the great celestial emperor who ruled all under heaven. In exchange, the Chinese emperor gave gifts to the emissaries and recognized the legitimacy of the Korean ruler. Hence, in theory, the Korean king's authority to rule came from the Chinese emperor, who received his authority from heaven. Thus, Korea was part of the tributary system through which the Middle Kingdom conducted relations with its neighboring states. Korea was often considered a model tributary, with its emissary given a special seat of honor next to the emperor. This tributary status should not be taken too literally, however. It was mostly a fiction to flatter the Chinese ruler and to link the authority of the Shilla kings to the celestial emperor. In reality, Korea was a completely independent state, but the fiction served both sides. Palhae, the other Korea? The question of whether Korea was united under Shilla or whether there were two Koreas has animated Korean historians for three centuries. The debate centers around Palhae, Shilla's northern neighbor. The state was founded in 713 and for two centuries, until its destruction by Central Asian invaders in 926, it was a formidable neighbor to Shilla. Based primarily in southern Manchuria, it ruled part of northern Korea, and at its peak extended to the Amur River on what is now the Chinese-Russian border. Its warlike rulers drove Tang and Shilla together as allies. Shilla built a wall across the peninsula, a miniature Great Wall, to keep it at bay. Yet over time, Pulhe came under Chinese cultural influence, adopting Chinese as an official and literary language, and sometimes engaging in peaceful trade with both Tang and Shilla. In the 18th century, a Korean historian argued that Pulhe, which often claimed to be a successor to Goguryeo, was really a Korean state. If this were true, the United Shilla period was not actually a period of Korean unification, but one of two Korean kingdoms. Ever since, Korean scholars have been asking whether Pulhe was Korean. If this were the case, it would require a significant shift in our perspective on Korean history. The period of Korean political unity would be shortened, and Manchuria would also be a part of the historic Korean homeland, not a foreign frontier. Adding to the historical confusion are recent claims from China that Pulhe was, in fact, somehow Chinese. All this adds fuel to the ongoing controversy between the more extreme nationalists in Beijing and their Korean counterparts as to whether Northern Korea is historically part of China or whether much of Manchuria was historically part of Korea. Interestingly, if Pulhe was a Korean state, the current division of the country into North and South would not be unprecedented. Most evidence, however, indicates that while Pulhe may have had some ethnic groups related to the ancestors of modern Koreans, including elements of the Goguryeo people, it was mainly a Manchurian-based state that was not ethnically Korean, having more in common with the later semi-nomadic empires of Northeast Asia than with Korea. The great majority of ethnically Korean people lived in Shilla. Thus, it is not unreasonable to regard Shilla, with its institutions and practices that continued on in later dynasties, as the first unified Korean state. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the latter three kingdoms. In the late 800s, Shilla went into decline. This is a familiar pattern. Pre-modern history in general tends to be the story of rise and decline. A state or empire emerges and prospers, the population grows, its arts and crafts flourish, and it expands. Then it declines, its borders contract, its population shrinks, the quality of its crafts slips, and its intellectual achievements become less impressive. There are many reasons to explain this. The limits of pre-modern technology are a major factor. States reach a technological and organizational limit to their capacity to administer and control a large territory or population. Peace and prosperity encourage a growing population that is beyond the ability of their technology to feed and support. The weight of tradition also stifles innovation as new problems arise. External factors often play a role, creating new pressures or upsetting the larger environment that enabled the society to flourish. All these things seem to have happened to Shilla in the 9th and early 10th century when it went into decline. It was not alone. China's Tang, and to a later extent Heian Japan, also experienced a political and economic downturn at this time. Incidentally, so did Carolingian Europe and the great Abbasid Caliphate that ruled the Middle East. Historians, at least those who pay attention to such things, do not agree on why this happened in so many places at the same time, but something certainly was affecting much of Eurasia. By the later 10th and 11th centuries, much of the area, including Korea, underwent a politically reconstituted revival. Both a symptom and a cause of Shilla's decline was that aristocrats began to win the tug of war with the king. While this was happening, revenues to the central government declined, which further weakened the throne's ability to compete with its most powerful subjects and led to a downward spiral in the central government's authority. The state and the society as a whole also suffered from shrinking trade with China as that vast empire entered its own political and economic decline. As the Shilla state weakened, local bandits plagued the countryside. Provincial aristocrats began forming private armies and calling themselves generals, a sign that much of the country was in the hands of local strongmen or castle lords, as Koreans often refer to them. One famous regional strongman who emerged in the 840s was the maritime commander Chang Poko, a man of humble background. He was in charge of a fortress off the southern coast of Korea built to fight pirates, but converted it into his own fiefdom. He expanded his power outward, controlling the majority of the sea lanes between Korea, Japan, and China, and became known as the King of the Yellow Sea. Chang made a bid to extend his influence over the court by helping to seat a contender to the throne, and then offering his daughter to the new crown prince. He was assassinated, but the fact that a total outsider with a questionable background came close to controlling the throne was unsettling to the established order. An already weakening monarchy went into further decline during the reign of Queen Qin Song, 887 to 97. During her decade of rule, the peasantry rose up and bandits took over much of the countryside, among them a gang with the interesting moniker of the Red Pantaloons. While the kingdom was crumbling, Qin Song surrounded herself with handsome young men and engaged in lewdness, or so later historians reported. At the end of her reign, the kingdom was on the verge of disintegration, making her an object lesson in the folly of letting women rule. Koreans took the lesson to heart. The country didn't see another female leader until the 21st century. Soon afterward, in 900, Silla broke up into three kingdoms, Silla, later Pyeongche, and later Goguryeo. This period, which Koreans refer to as the Later Three Kingdoms, lasted only until 936, when the country was reunified. It was the only period of disunity until 1945. Three major figures emerged during the Later Three Kingdoms, referred to aptly by the historian C. Cameron Hurst as the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Kyonhwan, the Bad One, was a provincial warlord in the southwest who proclaimed himself king of Pyeongche in 900. His state, located in the area of the original Pyeongche, became known as later Pyeongche. Kung Ye, the Ugly One, was related to the Silla royal family, although sources are contradictory on the nature of the relationship. Exiled to the north, he made alliances with a couple of bandit leaders, turning on them when they no longer were useful to him. After killing the second, Yang Qil, in 901, Kung Ye declared himself ruler of a restored Goguryeo, or later Goguryeo, as historians have called it. Kung Ye's avowed aim was to destroy Silla and its capital, Gyeongju, which he hated passionately. As being a king was apparently not enough for him, he announced that he was the Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha of the future. He and his sons wore elaborate outfits and staged ostentatious processions to awe his subjects. Claiming that he possessed the power to read minds and see into the future, he murdered officials who were, he claimed, considering acts of disloyalty, or would commit them later. In fact, he seems to have been suspicious of almost everyone around him. After murdering a wife, two sons, and several trusted officials, Kung Ye was killed by his own generals, who then put Wong Kan, the Good One, into power. Wong Kan's background is a bit murky. Like Chang Poko, he seems to have had maritime connections with a base of operations on the islands off the west coast. After succeeding his former boss Kung Ye, he renamed the state Goguryeo, a name derived from Goguryeo. What was left of Silla, now the weakest of the three states, allied itself with Goguryeo against later Pyeongche, whose leader Kyeongwan devastated the Silla capital. Then one of Kyeongwan's sons, Shingyeom, murdered his brother, the designated heir, and imprisoned his father. Kyeongwan escaped and fled to Wanggeon's camp. Wanggeon, who of course had plenty of blood on his hands, was able to pose as the avenger of Kyeongwan, whose son had committed a most heinous act of unfilial conduct. In 935, the last Silla king abdicated the throne, recognizing Wanggeon as his successor. The following year, Wang defeated Shingyeom and reunified the country. This whole episode of Korean history, chock full of murder, betrayal, revenge, and the final triumph of the righteous, is subject to varying interpretations. did the conjuring up of the old Pyokche and Go-Korea kingdoms mean Korea was not so unified? Were the people of Pyokche, Shilla, and Go-Korea ethnically or linguistically distinct? Historians don't agree on the answers. In any case, the history of this time has been written by the victors, that is, from the Goryeo point of view. Its historians were eager to put Wonkyon, the dynastic founder, in the most favorable light, and to make the man he replaced, and perhaps assassinated, appear as villainous as possible. Emphasizing continuity with Shilla, they portrayed its last rulers as weak, but not bad. The first real Korea, the Goryeo Kingdom. Wonkyon began a nearly five-century dynasty that ruled the state he called Goryeo. The English name Korea is derived from this name, and Goryeo is still one of the common names used by Koreans for their country, along with Joseon and Hankuk. Was Goryeo a new state, or just a new dynasty? Mostly the latter. The name was derived from Go-Koryeo, and the capital shifted northward to Kaesong, 50 kilometers, 31 miles north of Seoul, just inside the modern North Korean border. It is possible to see it from the South Korean side. It had a good location near the center of the peninsula in the important Han River basin. Gyeongju and Pyongyang, the old Go-Koryeo royal center, were secondary capitals. Wonkyon was careful to establish himself as the successor in Shilla. He married into the royal Kim family and appointed Shilla aristocrats to key positions in his government, and his chroniclers were careful to point out that the last king of Shilla had designated him as successor. He left many of the existing officials and institutions in place, but many of the same problems remained in place, too. Goryeo, like Shilla, faced the task of creating a centralized state out of a land of powerful warrior aristocrat clans rooted in their home bases. The mountainous geography, with its numerous little valleys and ridges, reinforced the autonomy of the local castle lords. In an effort to bind these clans to his new dynasty, Wonkyon married their daughters, eventually winding up with 28 wives. But this only complicated the succession when he died. Each of the great families he had married into had their own private army and aimed to put their son-in-law on the throne. The result was bloody chaos. Wonkyon made only modest headway in creating a unified, centralized state. Those who came after him were more successful, especially his fourth son, who became King Gwangchun, ruled 949-75. Gwangchun, who succeeded to the throne after a brief power struggle, was determined to enhance the authority of the monarchical state, and used several means to do so. He increased the power and prestige of the monarchy by proclaiming himself Huangche, emperor. He renamed Kaesong Hwangdo, meaning imperial capital. This was a radical step, since Korean kings had always accepted the Chinese emperor as supreme. Only in 1897, during the twilight of the Korean monarchy, did a king proclaim himself emperor again. Gwangchung also tried to weaken the aristocracy by limiting the number of slaves they could own, freeing tenant farmers, and carrying out violent purges of high-ranking officials from powerful families. None of these efforts proved successful in the long run. His successors abandoned the imperial title, avoided bloody purges of aristocrats for the most part, and let them keep their slaves. Gwangchung did, however, take one measure that not only strengthened the state, but truly transformed Korea. In 958, Chinese scholar Sheng Qi assisted the king in setting up a civil examination system to select officials for the state. That year, seven men were selected to serve the kingdom after passing exams testing their mastery of Chinese classics, their literary skills, and their knowledge of geomancy. It was a modest beginning, but gradually the civil service examination became a path for ambitious aristocrats to achieve higher or lower office in the military or civil service. The importance of the civil service exams can hardly be exaggerated. Over time, they transformed the Korean aristocracy, turning sword-wielding fighters who were as ready to defend the kingdom as they were their own lands into writing, brush-wielding scholars and bureaucrats who loyally served the state. The change came slowly. In Goryeo times, the majority of officials still acquired their positions through family connections, but those who passed the exams gained great prestige and influence. The exams not only bound officials to the state, but also acted as a homogenizing force in two ways. First, aristocrats all studied the same curriculum, so they began to share the same culture. They also developed nationwide teacher-student networks and classmate bonds. A unified, shared culture among the aristocracy emerged, along with a shared identification with the kingdom they served. At the same time, the state benefited from being governed by an increasingly literate bureaucracy. As it was consolidating itself internally, Goryeo encountered three major external threats, all from mounted warrior people of the north: the Khitans, the Churuhens, and the Mongols. The Khitans were the first threat, becoming Goryeo's new neighbors after they destroyed Palhae in 926. Wang Gyeon hated them, calling them a nation of savage beasts. When they sent envoys with a gift of 50 camels, he banished the envoys to an island and let the camels starve. But this did not eliminate the Khitan problem. The tribe formed a Manchurian state called Liao and used it as a base to raid parts of northern China and Korea, including Goryeo, three times in 993, 1010, and 1018. The Goryeo forces had the advantage of fighting in heavily forested and mountainous terrain, not the best environment for mounted archers to operate in, and were able to score some victories, but still ended up paying tribute to the Liao. The troubles with the Khitans ended in 1126 when Liao was conquered by a second group of warriors, the Churuhens. Being the ancestors of the later Manchu, they were even more formidable than the Khitans had been, but directed most of their attention toward China, eventually conquering most of the northern part of that empire. The Goryeo paid tribute to the Churuhen and were spared any major upheaval. The Khitans and the Churuhens were not just a serious military challenge. They were a serious financial burden due to the costs of defending against them and paying tribute. Furthermore, the suspicious Chinese were reluctant to enter into maritime trade with Goryeo, since it had established tributary relations with the Manchurian warrior states. With the overland trade routes closed off, this separated Korea from China, a loss for Korea as it was the era of the prosperous Song dynasty, in many ways a high watermark in China's pre-modern technological and economic development. Still, there was some trade, giving Goryeo a few opportunities to benefit from the extraordinary achievements and rich culture of Song China. Meditating monks, competitive aristocrats, and rebellious slaves. Goryeo society. Goryeo, despite its limited contact with China, saw a growing Chinese influence reflected in its art, literature, and government. The elite wrote poetry in classical Chinese, dressed in Chinese fashions, and read Chinese tales. The kingdom also adopted Chinese historical traditions, employing historians to keep records. Detailed accounts of each reign were written upon the death of a king, helping move Korean history into a clearer light. These accounts were later compiled into the Goryeo, or History of Korea, a valuable resource for scholars. The history of Korea before Goryeo was also written. One such account, the Samguk Saki, History of the Three Kingdoms, is the first great work of historical scholarship to survive in its entirety today. Edited by Korea's most famous historian, Kim Bushi, and completed in 1145, the Samguk Saki, which covers Korean history from the founding of the Three Kingdoms to the end of Silla in 935, is our most important source for early Korean history. In the Goryeo kingdom, society continued to be divided into three major social classes: the aristocracy, commoners, and lowborn or mean people. The aristocracy, for the most part, comprised the same elite families that had dominated Shilla, with some newer ones emerging and some old lineages disappearing. Each elite family was identified by place of origin. While many shared the family name Kim, they were from different clans. The Kyungju Kim were descendants of the Shilla royal family. The Kangnun Kim hailed from the Kangnun province. The Hangchon Kim were descended from the old Kaya Confederation, and so on. Originally, only the aristocracy belonged to these clans, but now all Koreans do, which is why so many today share the same few surnames. The many Kims, Lees, and Parks are subdivided into different clans named for their ancestral home. Among the elite, the two sexes mixed freely. Men and women drank, danced, played cards. The earliest known playing cards are from Korea, but card games probably originated in China, rode horses, and even participated in mixed polo games together. Xu Qing, a 12th-century Chinese visitor who wrote an account of Korean life, was shocked by the failure of Korean men to restrict the activities of their women. They even bathed together. Women could divorce their husbands and gain custody of the children, and could inherit property. In fact, family property was divided equally among sons and daughters. A woman kept her property even after marriage, and she could pass it on to her children. Women sometimes headed households. They did not serve in government, which was men's work. Nonetheless, Korean women, like Japanese women at the time, were among the least restricted in the civilized world. While Confucian ideas were gaining influence, Buddhism remained central to Korean culture as a state protective cult. Monasteries protected the kingdom not only by praying for it, but by literally fighting for it. Many temples had warrior monks who were skilled in the use of weapons and martial arts. Many were excellent archers. Kings and officials consulted monks for their spiritual assistance and advice. Still, rulers had to keep an eye on the Buddhist establishment. Monasteries owned huge quantities of land and slaves and could emerge as a rival power to the court and the bureaucracy. Korean samurai and Korean shoguns. The period of military rule. In the 1100s, the aristocratic clans were divided into two groups of lineages, the Munpan, or civil officials, and the Mupan, or warrior officers, who carried out the older martial traditions of the warrior aristocracy. Together they were known as the Yangpan, the two sides, since military and civil officials sat on either side of the king. Eventually, Yangpan became the common term for aristocrat. The Munpan were proud of being calligraphers, poets, and men of learning, and they looked down on the military lineages. They came to dominate state and society, while the Mupan declined in status and power and were increasingly left out of major decision-making. Even during times of war, civil officials were put in command of the forces above the generals. In 1170, however, this historical trend reversed itself dramatically when the military officials seized power in a bloody coup led by Cheong Chung-pu, a commander of the Royal Guard. While Cheong came from a powerful Haechu Cheong clan, he was part of the less prestigious Mupan military lineage. He and other military leaders felt increasingly sidelined from power and disregarded by the court officials. The ultimate humiliation reportedly took place when Kim Dun-chung, son of Kim Bu-shi, set fire to Chung's beard to the amusement of the court. It was the last straw. When King Ui-chung and his many courtiers were away visiting a temple, Chung and his military comrades murdered most of the remaining members of court. Then they exiled the king to the remote Hoche Island. This island, incidentally, served as an internment center for the North Korean and Chinese prisoners during the Korean War. Ui Chung was later rolled up in a blanket and drowned, a way to avoid shedding royal blood. The crown prince was exiled to another remote island, Jindo. Chung placed a puppet king, Myeongchung, on the throne and created a supreme military council to govern the kingdom. Many civil officials were purged, and while those that remained were allowed to continue to function, real power was held by the military rulers, their retainers, and their slaves. Chung's coup unleashed 26 years of continual turmoil in the capital as generals plotted and ousted each other. Chung himself was killed by a rival military commander in 1179. Meanwhile, chaos spread to the countryside, where peasants rose up against landlords and local officials, and slaves rebelled against their masters. The most famous incident occurred when a slave named Man Cho organized a general uprising of his fellow slaves, but was betrayed and killed. Everyone, it seemed, was rebelling or fighting. Buddhist temples proved no refuge from the disorder. Rather, the warrior monks contributed to the violence and instability of the time. Unrest only increased when Yi Weimin, an especially cruel and corrupt general from a slave background, came to power. The turmoil finally came to an end in 1196, when General Che Chung Hon murdered Yi Weimin and seized power. Che restored order to Korea, putting down the peasant revolts and slave rebellions. He did this in part by appointing some of the rebel leaders to positions in government, meeting some of their demands, and relieving some low-born people of their status. He took control of the Buddhist monasteries, severing their ties to the courts and curbing the power of the armed monks, and exiled many Buddhist leaders who had been active in public affairs from the capital. He also restructured the military to make it subordinate to him. Che's most radical move was to establish a dual government. He maintained the king, the court officials, and the civil bureaucracy with little change from before, but created a parallel house government directly under his control. The monarchs continued to reign, but only at his pleasure. He removed two of them when they became unreliable. Real power was in the house government, staffed by his own retainers or by officials personally loyal to him. At its apex was the Office of Decree Enactment, which he headed. Che was too clever to let untutored retainers completely run the government. Instead, he appointed distinguished scholars from the civil lineages to serve him as well. So effectively did he maintain control over the country that he smoothly transferred power to his son, Che Yu, who further elaborated on the house government. Che Yu was succeeded by his son, Che Hong. The parallel military government of the Che family was remarkably similar to the Japanese shogunate created by Che Chung Hon's contemporary Minamoto Yoritomo in Japan in 1192. Yoritomo's rule marked the start of what is thought of today as Samurai Japan. In both Korea and Japan, effective power passed from the court-centered aristocracy to the military in the late 12th century. In both, following a period of conflict, a strong, effective ruler created a parallel military clan government that held the real power, while maintaining the monarchy and older civil institutions. Yoritomo became the first shogun, or paramount military commander, just 4 years before Che established a similar military-led house government in Korea. Both Che and Yoritomo made use of an elaborate system of military retainers and military leaders who pledged their personal loyalty to them. How was it that such a curious but similar development took place simultaneously in both countries? Were they influenced by each other? We don't really know, since until fairly recently, historians of Japan didn't pay that much attention to what was going on in Korea and vice versa. But clearly it could not have been coincidental. There were, of course, differences. The families that created the Japanese warrior government that ruled into the 19th century came from provincial nobility, while the military rulers of Korea were more linked to the central aristocracy. Che Chung Hon came from a distinguished line that traced itself to famed Shilla scholar and official Che Chi Won. Still, the parallels are striking. The two military clan governments resembled each other in another way. Both patronized Zen Buddhism. Zen, or to call it by its Korean name, Sun, was a form of meditative Buddhism that came to Korea from China. Its legendary founder, Bodhidharma, was a missionary from India who came to China and introduced a way of seeking enlightenment through quiet meditation. According to legend, Bodhidharma pulled off his eyelids so he wouldn't fall asleep, and they turned into tea plants. He meditated so long that his legs atrophied and fell off, which is why in Japan he is portrayed as legless. Sun appealed to the military men for its discipline. It did not require ostentatious ceremonies or countless hours spent mastering sutras. Rather than having monks involving themselves in politics, the idea of having them engage in quiet meditation somewhere off in the mountains was attractive to the Che military rulers, who were great patrons of Sun. An outstanding figure in Sun Buddhism was the monk Chinul, a contemporary of Che Yu, who founded the Songgwansa Monastery on Mount Chogye in southern Korea, which is still a religious center. A unifier, not a divider, his interpretation of Sun incorporated many of the practices of the rival Buddhist traditions. His sect, known as Chogye, after the mountain, is the largest denomination of Buddhism in Korea today. The Mongols arrive. Korea under Mongol hegemony. We can only speculate how Korea might have evolved if the rule by the Che shogunate had continued. Would it have developed a semi-feudal military system like Japan's? Would Korea have developed a samurai culture, too? There are reasons to think otherwise, since the Chinese model of civil bureaucracy was very strong. Even the Che family respected the court and its traditions. In any case, it is impossible to know, since the Mongol invasions brought the period of military rule to an end. Korea had seen many invaders from the great grasslands of Central Asia, but none as formidable as the Mongols. Numbering less than 1 million in all, the Mongols defeated almost every rival and created the greatest empire the world had seen. Korea had been threatened by the Khitans, then the Chuchens, but had been able to deal with these mounted warriors by resisting them, fortifying its borders, and when necessary paying them off with tribute. But none of these strategies worked when the Mongols came in the 12th century. The Koreans first encountered the Mongols in 1218. That year, the forces of Genghis Khan arrived at the border demanding that the Koreans pay tribute in the form of clothing, furs, and horses. The latter was particularly burdensome, since Korea's lack of grazing land made horses expensive. In 1225, the Mongol envoys were murdered by bandits, and Che Yu stopped paying. The Mongols, after a delay, sent an invading army in 1231. Faced with this mighty force, Goryeo agreed to start paying tribute, and the Mongols sent overseers to supervise the collection. The following year, Che Yu murdered the Mongol overseers and stopped sending tribute, and the Mongols predictably returned with an even greater force under one of their great commanders, Sartak. Che, expecting a massive Mongol retaliation, had a plan. As formidable as the Mongols were, they were not adept at moving across water. He therefore moved the entire government to the island of Kanghwa, a small 10-by-17-mile island north of modern Incheon. An entirely new capital was constructed there, complete with palaces, offices, and temples, was built on this tiny island just off the coast. From this bastion, literally within shouting distance of the mainland, the Koreans would shout out insults to the frustrated land-bound Mongols. The Koreans waged a war of resistance for the next 26 years. Sartak's invasion ended when a monk killed him with an arrow and his forces left. But they soon returned. From 1233 to 1241, the Mongols launched continuous invasions, but failed to decisively defeat Goryeo. Finally, the Koreans agreed to pay tribute, but would not leave the island. Soon the Korean military leaders again refused to pay tribute, hoping the invaders would give up and leave them alone. But the Mongols resumed their invasions. This time they took up a new strategy of sending small forces to lay waste to the country. The results were devastating, with villagers massacred, homes destroyed, and fields burnt. A reported 200,000 people were captured and taken away as slaves. Korean histories record that the Mongols passing through a valley would kill every living thing, leaving not even a dog or a chicken alive. After 4 years of this, the last Che ruler, Che Wi, was killed in a coup. According to the chroniclers, he was too fat to climb over a wall and escape the conspirators. A new government agreed to truce terms, which this time included sending members of the royal family as hostages. Some military commanders still refused to accept Mongol suzerainty and continued to resist. The last Goryeo commander was defeated on what is now the modern resort island of Jeju in 1273. The Korean resistance to the Mongols was certainly impressive. While it is true that the main attention of the steppe conquerors was on completing their conquest of China, no other state other than the South Song in China held off the Mongols for so long or endured so many repeated invasions. From 1270 to 1356, Korea was a semi-autonomous client state of the Mongol rulers based in China. The Mongol leader Kublai Khan completed the conquest of China in 1279, which he and his successors ruled as the Yuan dynasty, making Beijing, or Kanbalig, as they called it, their capital. Goryeo, while a nominally independent state, was in reality an appendage of this empire. Members of the royal family spent time at the Yuan court in Beijing. After submitting to the Mongols and accepting them as overlords, the Korean king married his son to the daughter of Mongol ruler Kublai Khan. Goryeo kings also provided primary consorts to Mongol emperor kings, linking the royal houses. Just to be sure of their continued loyalty, however, the Mongols also set up an Eastern Expedition field headquarters in Korea to keep an eye on the locals. Lacking the expertise to build a navy, the Mongols ordered Koreans to build ships and supply sailors to transport a Mongol army to Japan in 1274. The invasion force sailed during the typhoon season. Not surprisingly, after inconclusive fighting in western Japan, it had to return as a typhoon approached. For some reason, the Mongols learned little from this experience. A second Korean-built armada landed in 1281, also in typhoon season, and was destroyed by a typhoon. The Japanese called these typhoons that saved them the kamikaze, divine winds, and later built a myth that their country was protected by the gods. But no gods protected the Koreans. These invasions and an aborted third one were costly burdens. Another burden, as well as humiliation, was having to provide women to the Mongol elite as tribute. For the women themselves, this meant leaving their home country and family behind. But it sometimes worked out well, since many of them ended up married to wealthy and powerful Mongols. One, Lady Qi, the daughter of a low-level official, became the Empress of the Mongol Empire. The Qi family became one of the most powerful in Korea. In some ways, the Mongol-dominated period was not so bad for Korea. Korea maintained itself as a separate state with its traditional institutions and customs. There was only modest interference in internal affairs. The period of rule by the military lineages was over, and for the most part, the pre-existing social structure and old ruling clans resumed their place in government. In fact, there was a significant positive benefit. Korea was now part of a great cosmopolitan empire. As never before or after, foreigners of all types entered the country. Koreans in Beijing and elsewhere mingled with Chinese, Mongols, Turks, Tibetans, Persians, Russians, and people from all over Eurasia. As a result, new ideas and technology were introduced to Korea, such as cotton and cotton weaving and the use of gunpowder and the art of casting cannons. Another innovation that became important in Korean culture was distilled liquor. The colorless, potent, and popular Korean drink called soju dates from this time. New ideas about art and fashion were introduced. In fact, Korean traditional clothes still worn today on special occasions are partly derived from the fashions of the Yuan court. The most important influences came from China, especially Chinese literature and philosophy. After the Mongols. By the mid-14th century, the Yuan state had weakened. In 356, Zhu Yongcheng, a former monk, established the Ming dynasty in Nanjing and drove the Mongols out of southern China. In 368, Ming forces captured Beijing, and the Mongols were forced back to their homeland, where the remnant of their empire, now called the Northern Yuan, still controlled parts of Manchuria. Koreans became divided between those who remained loyal to the Mongols and those who sought alliance with China's new Ming dynasty. King Kongmin, ruled 1351 to 74, saw an opportunity and turned against the pro-Mongol faction, abolishing the Eastern Expedition Field Headquarters. A few years later, Korea resumed its tributary relationship with China and adopted the Ming calendar. Gongmin lost control of events when his Mongol wife died, however. Grief-stricken, he sat for hours each day staring at her portrait. Administration fell into the hands of his chief official, Shindong, a monk from a slave background. Two strikes against him in the eyes of the courtiers. Both the king and the monk were assassinated, and a couple of puppet monarchs sat on the throne while various strongmen and factions vied for power. An already volatile situation became more so when the Mongols tried a comeback, and Korea got caught up in the conflict between the Mongols and the Chinese Ming forces over control of Manchuria. Pro-Ming and pro-Mongol factions now contended for power in the capital of Kaesong. Meanwhile, a group of bandits, known as the Red Turbans, marauded the northern provinces, adding to the turmoil of the times. When the Ming began to build fortresses in the northern Hamgyong province of Korea, the pro-Mongol faction in power at the time sent General Isong-ke to attack the Chinese. He switched sides, however, and turned back and seized power in a coup. Proclaiming himself king in 1392, he ended the 5 centuries of Wang family rule and began the new Yi dynasty. The kingdom was renamed Chosun, and a new era in Korean history began. The Mongols lost out in their attempted return to power and ceased to be a factor in Korean affairs. Still, their invasions and domination of Korea had several consequences. They ended the period of rule by the military lineages, returning the rule of Korea to the civil aristocracy. The invasions themselves were terribly destructive and resulted in the loss of much of the country's architectural, artistic, and literary heritage. It is still painful to think of the cultural treasures that perished as the invaders pursued years of scorched earth campaigns. The experience with the Mongols probably contributed to the fear of outsiders that characterized later Korean times. But being part of the Mongol Empire also had the positive effect of exposing Koreans to foreign cultures and allowing for the flow of new innovations and ideas. Among the latter was the creed known today as Neo-Confucianism, which will be discussed in the next chapter. As this new ideology took hold, the Buddhist period effectively ended. Legacy of Koryo. Despite the ravages of the Mongols, Korea left behind a rich cultural legacy, including Celadon ceramics, the Tripitaka Koreana, achievements in printing, and 2 great histories. Koryo Celadons were among the finest ceramics ever made. The beauty of the classic green-tinted vases and figurines with floral inlays has never been matched. They can be seen in a number of museums, and cheap reproductions are sold at virtually every souvenir shop in South Korea. Then there was the Tripitaka Koreana, 81,000 hand-carved wooden printing blocks containing the world's most complete Buddhist canon. On these blocks is carved 52 million Chinese characters, amazingly without a single error. The blocks, which weigh 280 tons, would be as high as Pektu Mountain if they were stacked up. The Tripitaka Koreana that exists today is actually the 2nd set, ordered by the king after the destruction of the original by the Mongols in 1232. The original set was made in the 11th century, over a period of 8 decades, but the replacement set was completed just 12 years after they were started. Housed today in the beautiful Haensa Temple in southern Korea, the skill, effort, and care evident in the creation of this remarkable achievement are a testament to the strength of Buddhism in 13th century Korea. Printing was invented in China, but the Korean craftsmen, drawing on their highly skilled metal casting techniques, developed the first movable metal type, the basis of all modern printing. In 1234, 2 centuries before Gutenberg, the first known book was printed using this technology. The Chikchi, an anthology of teachings by Sun monks printed in 1377, is the oldest such printed book in existence today. To the annoyance of Koreans, it is kept at the National Library of France. Of special importance to historians are the Samguk Sagi, History of the Three Kingdoms, mentioned earlier, and the Samguk Yusa, confusingly also translated as the History of the Three Kingdoms. Compiled by the monk Iyun in 1279, the Samguk Yusa is as important for its fascinating collection of stories as for its account of historical events, although it does add to our overall knowledge of early history. Perhaps the most important legacy of Goryeo is that it provided a long period during which Korea became a highly centralized state ruling over people with a common identity. The state was strong enough to survive the Khitans, the Churuchens, and the Mongols, and the identity proved durable enough to last to the present day. By the end of this period, we can speak with confidence of a single Korean society and culture, which is directly ancestral to the two Koreas of today.